I'm Jay Hughes, producer of Change Surfer Radio, and for the next half hour, I'll be your guide to a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future. Brought to you by the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies. Welcome to Change Surfer Radio. Stay tuned for an interview with Dr. Sue Savage Rumbaugh of the Iowa Great Ape Trust on her work on the intelligence of apes. Today I'm speaking with Dr. Sue Savage Rumbaugh. She's a lead scientist at the Great Ape Trust of Iowa, where she has pioneered the use of a number of new technologies for working with primates. These include a keyboard, which provides for speech synthesis, allowing the animals to communicate using spoken English, and a primate-friendly computer-based joystick terminal. She's the author of several books, including Kanzi, The Ape at the Brink of the Human Mind, and her work can be reviewed at iowagreatapes.org. Welcome, Dr. Savage Rumbaugh. And can you tell us a little bit about the new lab that you're building?
It's going to be a center eventually for the studies of cognition, intelligence, language, and culture in all four great ape species, gorillas, chimpanzees, orangutans, and bonobos. Mm-hmm. Right now we have bonobos and orangutans. It will be a place where people can come and experience firsthand the intelligence of apes. It will be a place where apes and humans can travel freely in forest conditions and communicate about their thoughts, desires, and intentions as they travel.
Now, your work has been critical of the presentation and the research on great apes in the past because of their habitats. In what ways do unnatural habitats constrain ape behavior and our ability to understand their intellectual capabilities?
Well, almost all mammals spend a good part of their day traveling, and certainly we humans travel. In fact, the one thing that happens to humans if they don't behave properly is they get put in prison, and the main thing about prison is you can't travel. So travel is an important component of being a mammal. It's even more an important component of being a primate, and we and all great apes are primates. So when you take away the right to have different experiences and move from place to place, you take away the right to plan that experiences, to plan who you're with and where you're going and why you're going, you take away the need to communicate and you take away the opportunity for proper cognitive development with regard to planning and intentionality.
That's probably a big problem for human beings as well, since we probably traveled an order of magnitude more in our Paleolithic origins than we do today.
All we have to do is get on a plane and fly around the world today.
Right. So in these environments that you're creating, are you seeing actually different kinds of behavior? Are you seeing more intelligent, more social behavior than you would in these more static environments?
Yes, because when you have places to go and individuals with whom to communicate, you can construct an interesting life. And because you have an interesting life, you have more to say. And as you have more to say, you reveal the intelligence that's probably present in apes elsewhere, but it's not revealed.
One of the facilities that you've built was for a group of the bonobos there where you work, and you've built a more or less human environment for them. You want to tell us a little bit about the thinking behind providing them with things like TV and a door that they can decide to open and close, because those certainly aren't native to their evolutionary environment, but are things that we take for granted.
Well, the most important thing is that they feel that they have a home, a place which is safe and secure. Now, in the wild, that might be considered a territory. Bonobos have probably between 15 and 25 kilometers that they regularly move about in. And they do encounter other groups of bonobos, but as they do so, there's a lot of exchange of vocalizations back and forth, and they come together more or less slowly, and there's a kind of an organization to the engagement. So they have a space that's theirs, and then they have space that they sometimes share with other bonobos. Just like humans have villages or campsites or homes, we have spaces that are ours, and then we negotiate the entrance of others into those spaces. When you take an ape and put it in a zoo and it's just in a cage and people can walk by any time of night or day, it's a great indignity at one level, embarrassment at another level, and the only word I know to use for it is dehumanization at another level. But since we don't think of them as humans, it doesn't bother us to dehumanize them. And if I say to de-apeize them or de-bonobonize them, it doesn't make any sense to anyone. But it is a kind of humiliation to be forever on display and be forever under the gaze of another who has entered into your space without you even having any say about it. It's the worst part of being in a zoo.
So in this, how many bonobos live in the home that you've created?
We have 7 there now.
And they control the front door. How do people gain entrance to the house?
Well, we still don't have our technology working that gives them complete control over the front door. We have to build a few more interface boards before they'll have complete control over the front door. Right now, the front door is essentially locked, and no one comes in unless the bonobos and I agree to that. The building is basically off limits to visitors or anyone coming in unless that's coordinated through the keyboard or through some kind of vocal engagement, because they can understand a lot of English and they can answer yes or no questions. You can call them on the phone and you can actually talk to them.
Well, actually, when I called you about 15 minutes ago, you were on a phone call with the bonobos. What's the nature of that kind of communication? Is it they have a synthesized yes-no voice, and then your vocal communication is transmitted into symbols on their keyboard?
No, I just speak to them in English, just like I'm speaking to you, and they can go, They can say words that are fairly clear, like for banana, and for raisin, and for peanut. And I can ask them, do you want me to do this or do you want me to do that? Give them a number of choices, and they can either be silent or go, or go, for things that they don't like. Or they can nod their heads, and they can also shake their heads, yes and no. So sometimes somebody on the other end will tell me that they're either nodding their head or shaking their head.
So is this dialect, this particular set of language codes that you've worked out with them, is this specific to this particular group, or do you notice, is this kind of a pan-bonobo accent that of ways of communicating with human beings?
Their ability to understand very complex levels of human English is specific to this group because they've been raised around people who speak English. So I could go to another group of bonobos and try to talk with them, and they wouldn't respond. They wouldn't carry on a vocal conversation, a dialogue back and forth like you and I are doing over the phone. Mm. They might make some calls in excitement if I made some bonobo excitement calls. They might imitate some food sounds if I made some bonobo food sounds. But if I just tried to talk to them in English, they just respond with silence and they ignore me.
Do they use the phone spontaneously to make requests of you and your team?
They do. They don't exactly know how to use the numbers to call on the phone. So I've gotten them these little phones for kids that I'm going to try to use in the future. They're not activated yet, but they have only like 6 numbers on them, and I'm going to see if they can keep them and keep them safe and learn to call people when they want to on them.
They control a television also, and I understand that they have favorite television programs. What are some of the favorite things that they like to watch?
Well, Pambanisha has always liked Harry and the Hendersons, and Kanzi has always liked Quest for Fire, and Inyota likes Black Hawk, a movie called Black Hawk. Those are the ones that I know to be their favorites. Those are the bonobos that communicate most effectively. We have another group that haven't been exposed to human English, and I can't have these kinds of conversations with them, and I don't really know what their favorite movies are.
Huh. Now, Kanzi, you mentioned you've written a book about Kanzi, and can you tell us a little bit about the importance of Kanzi and why you decided to focus on her as an example of the work that you've done?
Well, I had worked with chimpanzees, 5 chimpanzees, Sherman, Austin, Erica, and Kenton, and Lana, all of whom had been trained through behavioral techniques to associate symbols and objects. And in some cases, they had also been trained to string symbols together. So they had what you might call a semblance of language. They had something that looked like language, but it was very simple and very primitive, and they did not have a complex understanding of spoken language. They could, in some cases, if you said a word like outdoors or M&Ms, seemingly understand those single kinds of words, but you certainly couldn't converse with them as you might, say, a 10- or 12-year-old child and expect them to cooperate with you, to go places with you, to understand and to make novel expressions. That was very, it was seemingly very much beyond their capacity. When I got an opportunity to work with a different species, which was a species called bonobos, or the scientific designation is Pan paniscus, I thought that they might be more intelligent. So I started out trying to work with an adult female and her offspring. The adult female was named Matata, and I was trying to teach her through behavioral techniques that had been very successful in working with chimpanzees. However, because she was an adult and not a youngster when I started, she just didn't learn. I worked with her about 5 years, and at most she learned about 8 symbols, and she wasn't very good with the 8 that she had. But while I was working with her, she had a child, and he was exposed to me talking and working with her all of the time. And at one point, I was asked to separate them so she could become pregnant again. And at that point when I separated them, he just immediately started using the keyboard that he had seen used around him, but no one had ever taught him to use it. And he was so facile with these 8 symbols that I had been trying forever to teach her that I realized that maybe teaching was part of the problem. Maybe I shouldn't be trying to teach. And so I expanded the keyboard greatly, and I expanded his world tremendously. And I attempted to create an environment that was part human-like and part bonobo-like that he would enjoy, and many activities that he would enjoy, and just exposed him to language and many, many interesting situations, and cared for him the way you would a young child. And in his case then, language began to explode through comprehension first and then through production in a spontaneous way. So I never had to teach Conti. And I've since followed that same methodology with his sister Pambanisha and now with her son Inyota. And they are equally competent as Conti.
So is your part of your argument that there's a need to establish a kind of trans-ape sociality with these beings in order for them to want to communicate with us? Otherwise, they're just focused on the traditional communication that they have with their peers and don't want to use these symbols.
Well, that's certainly true. If you were to go to an indigenous tribe in New Guinea, for example, and you came in and sat down and didn't establish some kind of relationship with them, usually people bring in material goods and begin to try to trade. And if you don't know the language, until they accept you as a person in their group, they're really not going to communicate with you. And sometimes even anthropologists who go in as outsiders are tricked and not really communicated appropriately with until they've been through some kind of trial by fire, and the group really feels that they belong and that they're a member, and then the communication flows and the secrets begin to be shared.
Now, there are a number of different ways to compare apes, orangutans, gorillas, chimpanzees, and bonobos, and then ourselves as a cousin. And there's been a number of debates, I understand, about which of these species we're more similar to. And we usually think of chimpanzees, but I know that Franz de Waal and I think some others have argued that we're more similar to bonobos. Do you think that that's accurate, or is it just a matter of which metric you're using?
I think that once the bonobo DNA is fully sequenced, we may be able to answer that question at a level of physicality. In terms of behavior, there's no question but bonobo facial expressions, bonobo vocal capacity, and bonobo locomotor behavior is more human-like than is chimpanzee behavior in those same regards.
And so Franz has done a lot of work on the primate moral codes and those kinds of things, political behavior among these species. Is that something that you're also interested in, the ways that their social codes and moral behavior may be similar to our own?
Yes, we're very interested in that. We take a slightly different perspective than Franz in that we're pretty much convinced that these things are cultural and not instinctive or innate in any sense. And just as you have different cultural codes and different moral systems within human society, it's possible to have different moral systems and codes within societies of other apes. And the real interesting issue is how these develop and how these function at a group level across time, because we need to have ones that build us a better world, not ones that end up having us go to war all the time with each other.
I'm speaking with Dr. Sue Savage-Rumbaugh. She's a researcher on great apes at the Great Ape Trust of Iowa. You can find her work at iowagreatapes.org, and she's the author of a number of books, including Kanzi, The Ape at the Brink of the Human Mind. You mentioned that that we could might be able to learn things about living without conflict, and this is one of the oft-remarked differences between chimpanzees and bonobos and ourselves and bonobos, that they have a very pacific culture and that they have a very different attitude towards sexuality. Do you think that, is that what you're referring to, that we might be, not necessarily the sexuality part, but that the attitudes about how to resolve conflict might be something we could learn from them?
That is one of the things I'm referring to. Bonobos are able to exist in groups of up to 100, and most other apes have much smaller groupings. So somehow they're able to meet the needs of 100 bonobos as they travel through the forest. And you can imagine if 100 humans were to try to travel through the forest, how would we all agree where we were going to go? And what if we agreed to go one place and there wasn't enough food for everybody? Then would we get mad at the one that we followed? Would we dispose our leader? Would we break up into smaller groups? You know, there's some very important basic questions here that we have never addressed before with our closest living relatives. And as we begin to understand and appreciate the cognitive insight and capacity that they're bringing to a lot of the same social problems we have, we will get insights in ourselves into possibly better ways to do things.
So out of primate research, we now know that there's language acquisition, learning, transmission. There's cultural transmission among chimpanzees and these other species. And for a long time, the Great Ape Project, which I'm sure you're aware of, Peter Singer and others, have argued that these cognitive similarities to human beings are what's important on whether they should have similar rights to human beings. Do you think that, are you sympathetic? I presume you are sympathetic with the argument. And right now, Spain is considering extending human rights to include great apes. Where do you fit in that argument?
I think it's wonderful that Spain is considering that and that the debate is finally open and out in the public. I think that anyone that has had a close long-term association with great apes and has really attended to and studied their cognition in detail is firmly convinced that they deserve rights and that they are, as the genetic evidence suggests, far more closely related to human beings than they are to the other monkeys or other animals on the planet. We have something called the human-animal divide, and the apes have been placed on the animal side, and we've been placed on the human side. And all of the scientific evidence to date suggests that we have made a mistake, that apes belong in the human realm.
Hmm. You have written some very interesting things about the kinds of preferences about personal space and the kinds of rights that you might adduce from bonobo behavior from the preferences that they express in their behavior. For instance, you say that they have a desire to travel from place to place and to obtain their own sustenance and to plan ways of maximizing travel and resource procurement. What are kinds of behavior and communication have you used to try to elucidate these general list of demands, you know, principles that they want?
When I built the first environment or conceived of it for Kanzi, as he was only 2.5 years old and I wanted to make a world that he liked, I was lucky enough to have access at Georgia State University to 50 acres of forest. So So what I decided to do was put 16 or 17, eventually 18 food sites in that forest, just as if he were in a forest and he had trees that ripened. You know, if he wanted to go to a fig tree one time and a malingo tree later in the day and maybe feed in the swamp before the evening as he might in the wild, in that forest, it didn't naturally occur like that because it was a temperate forest, so fruiting season was only in the spring. To do that year-round, I had to have somebody carry food to the different places in the forest. So at one place, we always found the hot dogs. At another place, we might always find bananas. At another place, we always found mushrooms. And each place had a name. Not only was it associated with a specific food, it had a name, and it was often associated with a specific activity. And those names were placed on Kanzi's keyboard. He learned the layout of the forest in just a few weeks, and he always would take great pride in taking any visitor around to all of those different places in the forest and announcing where he was going to go, and then taking their hand and leading them to places that they had never been before. So from his general enjoyment and interest in doing that, I was able to design blind tests to show that he could clearly say where he wanted to go, he could predict where he was going, and he could take someone there that had never been there in the past.
In that regard, if we put apes, bonobos, and the others in a more human category of moral regard, if you had a human being, and as we did in the past, who was in living in the woods, we would have some qualms. On the one hand, we would want to respect their right to autonomy to live in the woods. On the other hand, we would see that they would be dying of diseases that we could treat, that they might be subject to violence that we could protect them from. And so we might want to bring them into a reservation or into some kind of more protected setting. So does this give you, how do you think about this in terms of having great apes in captivity and trying to create these more humane environments for them versus having all great apes be in the wild?
Well, I do think the great apes deserve a nation. I do think they deserve to have a life in the wild, and probably one of the best places is the Congo because it's the only country that has all three great ape species. They deserve an opportunity to exist like that, and we deserve an opportunity, as we've just now begun to understand their intelligence, to study them in those situations in a very benign way, in a way that doesn't affect their lives. Certainly, we see indigenous peoples that have diseases and indigenous peoples that we think we might help. Oftentimes, when we've attempted to give that help, it really hasn't helped them. And we are faced with many, many moral dilemmas. We do think that our culture, with all its material wealth, is the very best culture on earth. We do think that our ways of solving problems of illness happen to be right now the very best way on earth. But I'm not so certain that we currently have all the answers. Although we currently have greater material technology and we certainly have greater weapons, I'm not sure we have all the social answers. I think until we can devise a culture in which we no longer have war and we no longer fight and we no longer have to imprison people, we're not in a position to say that our culture is better than any of the other cultures in the world.
But
we need to be cautious.
But certainly, apes who are raised in captivity, as it were, it would not be humane to return them to the wild.
Not any more than it would a human child raised in New York to suddenly take it and return it to Wamba because there are some human beings that live in a different kind of culture in Wamba. If you wanted to do that with a child, then it should be a matter of the child's own free will, and it needs to be done very slowly and carefully.
One final question that I think will take us to the end is that we frequently talk about biomedical ethics on this show, and one of the questions that was raised last year by a group of about 25 bioethicists who wrote a consensus paper about human primate neural grafting of stem cell tissue, research that was being proposed to see if we could get human neural tissue to grow in primate brains and what kinds of consequences that might have. And the general question here is, we could do some research on great apes. I'm opposed to great ape research on the great ape rights basis, but we could do some research on great apes that might enhance their cognition in a human direction that you could argue would be in their own benefit and that would facilitate their own self-determination. How do you feel about that? Do you think that that argument, this paper by these bioethicists did not argue for it. It was benign on the question. But would you favor doing some kind of cognitive enhancement, pharmaceutical or genetic cognitive enhancement research on great apes?
Well, it is fascinating that the tissues of different mammals can be exchanged and can make connections. And we don't really understand all of the implications of the biological ability to do this. Probably my scientific position on it would be that before we begin to experiment with humans and apes in this regard, we might want to understand what is going on better in mice and other animals where these similar kinds of tissue grafts can occur. I'm not convinced that human intelligence is in human biology as apart from its existence in human society and human culture. My view currently, although I'm not conducting this experiment, is that if I were to take a bonobo and raise that bonobo with only human beings and completely integrate that bonobo into human society, taking it everywhere, taking it to church, taking it to Cub Scouts, having it wear clothes, giving it surgery to help it speak a little more clearly, et cetera, and never let it know that it was a bonobo, that it probably could do essentially all of the things that we human beings normally do. But I haven't done that because it would make that individual an oddity, a freak, and I must avoid, out of an ethical position, that kind of ultimate scientific experiment. It would, however, prove the degree to which we're biological beings versus the degree to which we're cultural beings.
Really test that nature-nurture question. Well, that's
push it to the limit, yeah.
Yeah, that's fascinating, and your work is really fascinating, and I recommend to everyone to go take a look at the iowagreatapes.org website where it is more fully described, and I've been talking with Dr. Sue Savage-Rumbaugh. She's the lead scientist of the Great Ape Trust of Iowa and has developed many different technologies, and she's written the book Kanzi, the Ape at the Brink of the Human Mind. Thanks so much for joining us today, Doctor.
Well, thank you for giving me the opportunity.
You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio, a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future, brought to you by the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies and produced at WHUS Stores at the University of Connecticut. I'm Jay Hughes, the host and producer of Change Surfer Radio and executive director of the IEET. If you want to learn more about the techno-progressive perspective of Change Surfer Radio and the IEET, or you want to share your thoughts about our programs, email me at director@IEET.org. You can find the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies at IEET.org. You can subscribe to a weekly podcast of Change Surfer Radio and listen to or download all of our shows since 1998, thanks to the Infos Radio Project at the Change Surfer website at changesurfer.com. So educate, agitate, and organize, and I hope to meet you in a sexy, high-tech, and yet radically democratic future.